Hello everyone and welcome to Negotiating Ideas, a podcast about political thought on democracy, pluralism and peace. My name is Omar Sadr. State fragility is a major threat to most of the states in the world. According to the World Bank, quote, by 2030, fragile states will be home to up to two-thirds of the world's extreme poor. Both low- and middle-income countries are affected by fragility risks. So far away from where the problem starts, end quote. So my guest today in this episode is Nematullah Bejan, who has recently come up with a book titled State Fragility, Case Studies and Comparison, where he tries to analyze state fragility and resilience through a multidimensional framework. Of course, we understand that a study of state fragility through multidimensionality has been done earlier in 2000, at least since 2010, by scholars such as Charles Call and many other scholars who follow Charles Call's framework, for example, Jon Grevenhult. But here, this book is fascinating because it provides us with almost seven case studies, which includes cases like Afghanistan, Pakistan, Lebanon, Burundi, Sierra Leone, Papua New Guinea, and finally Rwanda. Dr. Nematullah Bejan, it's so a pleasure to have you on Negotiating Ideas podcast. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure. And thank you for having me in the program.
Yeah, so pleasure and congratulations on your new book, the edited volume, State Fragility, Case Studies and Comparison, that I am interested to talk about the book with you in this episode. Let me start by asking a general question. Tell us about the book, and particularly if I ask, what is a new contribution? I mean, the concept of state fragility is a kind of steep maturation process. It has been almost three decades so far that the scholars in comparative politics and state building, peace building, are studying state fragility. So what is the value addition in terms of literature in this book?
Coming to your question, what we have done in this book is to look state fragility from a multidimensional perspective by looking at different dimensions of fragility, such as state capacity, legitimacy, authority, as well as economy and resilience to shocks, both political and economic shocks. So coming to the very question of how do we define state fragility, we define state fragility as a situation where the state suffers from deficiencies in capacity, legitimacy, authority, as well as weak economy and low resilience to shocks. What's different in this book in comparison to some other works that the emphasis is made on context and diversity. In particular, at the conclusion of the book, or which is the last chapter, is a brief chapter, which brings together some lessons learned about state fragility in the 21st century. I argue, or based on the evidence, we argue that attempts at the state fragility need to go beyond the state-centric, approach. So we make the case that one-size-fits-all approach is not working in reducing state fragility. In addition to state building, governments need to prioritize nation building and economic development. So what then the problem is that these attempts may work against each other. So that's why a thorough understanding is required of the context and the balance need to be established between them. So very much This book focuses or put the emphasis on the context, diversity, and also later on I will add more that confirms that we need more flexible approaches, not across different states, but even within single states.
Right. So I mean, in terms of, it's beautifully written on the first introduction also of the book, that the book is looking at the state fragility as a multidimensional kind of concept and process. But this issue of multidimensionality of state fragility was also, I mean, earlier scholars like Charles Cull or Jurd Gravenholt, they have been doing this kind of analysis, but through a kind of quantitative analysis, wherein they try to correct the earlier literature. For example, Rothberg had a one-dimensional study of state fragility. Then they brought these three concepts of legitimacy, authority, and capacity. But also, it seems that your book has two more concepts to that, a resilience and economic kind of dimension. So to what extent your work is different from Charles Cull and Jurd Gravenholt in terms of multidimensionality of fragility?
In terms of the framework, I mean, the term state fragility or the concept has been used since the end of Cold War or late 20th century. And then the concept has evolved. So coming to the framework, still I'm using the same framework in this book, but the difference is that I look beyond the three dimensions, which are quite common or have been used by other experts, scholars, such as legitimacy, authority, and capacity. So I also go beyond that by looking at other dimensions such as economy and resilience. Mm-hmm. So what I especially we found that we can find pockets of resilience and fragility in a single context, or so fragility and resilience can coexist. So these are some of the issues in particular in this book, as it is, the work is more qualitative work. So we had a chance to delve deeper by looking at each case study. So that's why in this book, we do not make the case for a grand theorizing of the state fragility, that there could be one pathway for reducing state fragility, rather than we are making the case that each context mm-hmm. is different. We need to appreciate the realities, whether we are focusing on institutions, society, or markets. So it may differ from one context to another context in one country. Institutions may matter the most in comparison to others or relatively and the others market.
What you mentioned now is also coexistence of resilience with fragility and pockets of fragility in a particular state. So the term that you used in the book is heterogeneous fragility. I would love to listen more on that, the concept of heterogeneous fragility, but particularly one of the key examples in the book about heterogeneous fragility is Pakistan, where certain states are much more resilient or strong, the others are not. Now, that may also be connected with a particular political system, which is a federal system. So federal system allows political autonomy, so that's why certain local administrations might craft their own sort of policies, and that will impact resilience of the systems. So my question is, do we also observe such kind of heterogeneous fragility in unitary states at the local level or not?
Yes, we can find heterogeneous fragility across different types of states. In particular, in the book, we found that market could be more resilient and even in a highly or private sector or highly fragile states such as Lebanon, one of the cases, or a regime could be more resilient or communities in a unitary but decentralized state such as Papua New Guinea. Or even in the case of Afghanistan, we had under the Republic in Afghanistan, a unitary state. We had more resilient, some of the government institutions, such as the finance. That resilience could coexist under different types of states. But the form of that could differ, especially in the case of Pakistan, because Pakistan is a federal state. The resiliences across different provinces and in Lebanon across different sectors, such as private sector or in Afghanistan across different formal institutions or then across communities. It could differ from one context to another context, but we cannot make the case that it can happen only in a particular form of political structure.
Right. So another example that I remember from Fukuyama's state building the book, he gives example of, I think, Latin America comparing to Egypt, where in Egypt, in certain sectors, security sector, state is much more efficient. But when it comes to banking or, for example, issuing passports, it might be so much fragile in terms of capacity. Anyway, but let's also talk about how these fragile states may impact each other when they are happen to be adjacent to each other, for example, neighboring countries like Afghanistan and Pakistan. Of course, for example, data from World Bank shows that war impacts not only the country where war is going on, but also the surrounding region. But to what extent fragility can also transfer across the border or spill over across the border?
So one of the difference, coming also back to your earlier question, is that mostly state fragility is seen as a national problem, aside from security threats to major powers in the world. But in fact, state fragility is a regional phenomenon, which I discuss in the book and also unpack that in the conclusion of the book. We can see a fragile state among more resilient states. That's one question. Two issues are quite important that we need to keep in mind. Number one is intervention by neighboring states, which induces a state fragility, and that problem is often neglected or underestimated. One example is the rule of Pakistan and Afghanistan. It induced the state fragility. That's one thing. Another example is Lebanon, that intervention by other regional states somehow prolonged the state fragility in Lebanon. That's one thing. The second issue is the problem of the spillovers, that the state fragility also affects neighboring states or spills over to neighboring countries. So I can give you the example of Afghanistan and Pakistan, that the situation in Afghanistan affected the border with Pakistan. So while Pakistan induces state fragility in Afghanistan, by and large, also the situation in Afghanistan reciprocated by affecting some parts of Pakistan. Especially, we can see that some of the provinces of Pakistan are quite fragile, but some others, such as Karachi, is relatively more resilient. And this is quite an important issue, and has been by and large neglected in the literature and also by policymakers.
Right. And now you also to not restrict a state building process only to capacity of state technically, but you also talk about how it's important to look at state-society dynamics. Now, in state-society dynamics, one of the probably a kind of paradoxical situation that some states like Afghanistan would face is that in order to improve its relationship with the society, it has to build relationship with certain form of interlocutors. And these could be those who are involved in the previous war, like warlords or local strongmen. So that improves the relationship at certain level. But at the same time, paradoxically, that also undermines the legitimacy of the state because this empowers or reinforces certain form of patronage. And now the question is, how can such kind of fragile state, when it comes to state-society relationship, balance one of the key goals and avoids the risk of it?
That's really an important question when it comes to building legitimacy in state capacity in situations of fragility. So what we found across different cases that often during the state building, the situation leads to state capture by certain groups. Then that encourages the development of less inclusive political and economic institutions, or I would call it exclusive by and large institutions. Mm-hmm. And especially in the 21st century, because people can have access to alternative sources of violence and information, so they can challenge different groups who are excluded, can challenge the established political order. So it comes really back to the notion of limited access order. While in this book, we found that in many of the cases we have studied, they had democratic systems in place, or at least the de facto arrangement was to have inclusive economic and political institutions. But the reality was that these countries suffered from state capture or more fragile limited access order, that a small group controlled political power and also economic resources. Mm. So definitely that led to prolonged fragility and also the reemergence of violence, although in the short term it could provide some sort of stability, but that stability was not lasting. So coming in particular to situations where we have weak institutions or there is weak statehood and we have a strong actor, so a strongman. So we have seen or found such cases in African, countries, some of the African countries included in our case studies, such as Rwanda, Burundi, Sierra Leone, and also we found that in the cases such as Afghanistan and Papua New Guinea. So that's quite challenging for the process of state building and also nation building. And another major problem in the process of addressing state fragility or in the process of state building is overemphasis on building formal institutions and having an expectation that those institutions will fix all the problems, and neglecting the need for nation building projects or nation building imperative. So that was another issue. So especially coming, which is quite important, if institutions to be lasting and to provide the stability, so they should be seen legitimate. So then that's why the notion of a state building becomes quite important. People can see themselves, they can be represented, and also they can be included so that they can own those institutions and provide support in the long term and accept those institutions as legitimate.
Right. So, yeah, limited access order in institutions are problematic in certain cases, but at the same time, in countries wherein democratizations happen at the onset of a war or a midst war, that could also be problematic in certain cases and may reinforce the state fragility instead of, for example, addressing it. This also has been studied thoroughly in the literature. But what were the cases that you have come across and the cases that are in the book wherein you have observed that democratization has, I mean, intensified fragility instead of addressing it?
So a number of cases. One is Afghanistan. I would be cautious to say that democratization prolonged fragility, but rather than a particular form of political arrangement, led to a situation that prolonged the state fragility and to collapse of the political order was neglecting the basic principles of having inclusive institutions, political and economic institutions, and also the form of political arrangement which led to a state capture rather than bringing different actors together for a fair go or fair play in a political system. So the cases, I can give you the example. One is Afghanistan, and then another example is Lebanon, and many of these cases represent a situation that power was controlled by a small or a group of people. But also, surprisingly, we found that after 1994, genocide in Rwanda, the country was able to build on lessons learned from the genocide era in Rwanda. The governments were able to overcome some of the challenges that the country faced, such as poverty or challenges of economic development. So what happened in Rwanda after the genocide? The leadership focused on using the state capacity to deliver services and also improve the security situation. And in return, that improved situation bolstered the legitimacy of the government, although the government in Rwanda is somehow defined as an authoritarian regime. To the question of legitimacy is that it's not only to have elections, but also it's important how political system is organized and how state society interact with each other. For example, in some other countries such as Sierra Leone, improved service delivery did not much help to improve the legitimacy of the governments. Why was that? Because identity politics or identity polity was quite strong in Rwanda. In Sierra Leone. It was important who you were rather than what you were doing. So similar issue in other contexts, but coming then to a transition was the most important and challenging question is how one could balance the question of transition, because we cannot neglect the realities of such as identity politics or weaker statehood, because definitely the tension arises. On the one hand, you need to deliver services. On the other hand, we need to build a state capacity and then improve the legitimacy. But if a thorough balance is not established, then one can undermine the other aspect of a statehood or state legitimacy.
Yeah. I mean, this will also create kind of dilemma for the aid community or those who are supporting state building or democracy support projects. For instance, whether to prioritize kind of support or aid to a state which has good enough capacity but lacks legitimacy. Let's say, for example, Saudi Arabia. It doesn't have democratic legitimacy, but it's in terms of authority and capacity very well. Or on the other hand, let's say a state like Mali, which may have legitimacy but lacks capacity. Or, for example, in Africa, you can give example of Namibia on one hand, and Somalia on the other hand. Somalia doesn't have effective institutions. So I think the beauty of multidimensional form of analysis of state fragility is to allow us to see and navigate whether capacity is good or legitimacy is good. And based on that, you can craft your policy. So in such kind of cases where you have, let's say, the case of Saudi Arabia and Mali that I gave you, one is good in terms of legitimacy, the other is good in terms of capacity. When it comes to aid, which one do you recommend, for example, where aid could be effective in terms of helping the state?
Thank you for that question. I would like to highlight two issues here. Number one is, especially when it comes to the tension of local priorities versus international priorities. And in that case, so if we have two different situations, one is having an authoritarian totalitarian regime, and the other one is having a democratic regime with weak state institutions. So one of the lessons learned is that it's better to emphasize local priorities, not international priorities, when working in a fragile situation. Why is that? Because if the emphasis of the international community or the donors are to focus on international priorities, such as safeguarding their security, a national security, rather than building lasting institutions or market in situations of fragility, that would undermine or prolong state fragility. But then the question is, in case if the government is totalitarian or authoritarian, one example is Afghanistan under the Taliban regime, what a possible pathway could be to make sure aid is delivered to the beneficiaries. So one question, how can we define local? Is local the local government or people? And there's two scenarios. First, if a state is government is democratic, but lacks the capacity, in this case, it's more important to align the foreign aid with government priorities or national priorities, and also use work with the government rather than bypassing it. But then with that situation, there is a paradox. The paradox is weak institutions, because that state cannot deliver. That's one issue. The second one is, in case if the state is totalitarian, is not legitimate in the eyes of, its own citizens or the international community. In that case, it could be paradoxical if international community or donors are working with that government. Why is that? Because first, it cannot be delivered to real beneficiaries. It can be politicized. And the second one is, then those donors cannot justify their aid being provided to such governments, such as the Taliban. In that case, the alternative for this in this situation could be to bypass the entire system or government and directly work with people, to non-state actors, to deliver aid. But the problem then would be that the scope of the aid would be quite limited to humanitarian and development aid, even mostly humanitarian aid. So that's quite paradoxical. And so now when we are talking about international community here, the concern is the traditional donors or Western donors, that for them democracy matter. But for some non-traditional donors, such as India and China, it doesn't matter which regime or government type is in place.
Yeah, and since we are talking about aid donation from external actors, of course, one of the key principles emphasized in the literature both policy and academic, was no harm principles to donor community. But in case of Afghanistan, it was clearly observed that international community didn't learn much lessons, or did not at least give attention to what some of these core principles outlined by scholars and policy advisors. Why was such the case?
On that question, there was two problems in the case of Afghanistan. Number one was, or the first one was, I mean, the imperative of security in Afghanistan. So state building was subverted by war on terror, or the U.S. priorities. And there was urgent need to deliver. There was a situation after 2001 in Afghanistan, there was high demand for service delivery. There was lack of state capacity, and there was fragmentation of the state institutions. And in between two, for donors, it was important to deliver their aid to non-state actors. So eventually it led to the creation of a parallel public sector. Until 2010, it was fiscally much more bigger than the formal public sector. 82% of aid was going to a parallel public sector, and 18% of aid was going to the formal state system. It was in the first decade after 2001. But eventually that situation improved, and donors committed to put more money to the national systems or work with the government in Afghanistan. That was one issue. And the second one was the problem with the state in Afghanistan as well, because we inherited and continued with a new patrimonial state in Afghanistan. And the arrangement was as such that political leadership would trade off, senior appointments and or other support in return for political support in Afghanistan. And that really weakened public institutions in Afghanistan. And also under the Taliban, we can see that the situation got worse. All mullahs or clergies were appointed in senior positions or leading the government, which somehow virtually led to the collapse of a viable public sector in Afghanistan. And these two factors really contributed to a situation that donors bypassed the government in Afghanistan. And also, in addition to that, some of the donors, such as the US and UK, they prefer to work with non-state actors. And that's part of their like broader vision of having an assessment of market and the state, and they prefer to market over the state, especially when it comes to the delivery. But one of the lessons learned is that it's quite important to build a state capacity if you want to address the fragility of a state. But then comes another question that we came across in this book, that always in the literature, the emphasis is put on building a state capacity. But the state capacity is not always good. The state capacity is important and good as far as the state is serving the interests of the nation. But otherwise, if that capacity is used to repress the population or against the people, then that would be the worst moment of a nation. One of the examples is Rwanda, a genocide in 1994. Mm-hmm. It happened to that scale because there was the state had a better capacity or improved capacity strength in Rwanda. And same, that capacity was used in a positive way after the genocide to deliver public services and improve the security. And now coming back to the case of Afghanistan, now we can see that in the last 20 years, the capacity which was being built in Afghanistan that capacity is not now used to help people rather than to repress the population, which is a sad situation. That's why when it comes to the issue of the state capacity, so we need to be cautious.
That's right. And probably the last question, if I ask, is to connect what you have mentioned and also concluding this. Before that, I can probably, if I give example of Singapore, which is one of the rare successful cases of transforming a third world country to a successful, very resilient first world state. Professor Kishore Mahbubani once coined MPH, which referred to meritocracy, pragmatism, and honesty, in order to transform a state. So Singapore is a good example of how meritocracy was prioritized, but at the same time, pragmatism, wherein things which work in certain contexts should be considered rather than the others. And finally, honesty, which probably will avoid the mistakes of the cases wherein state capacity is misused in order to suppress people, as in case of Rwanda. So having said this, if you can tell us what are the key differences of those successful cases of transforming a state towards a resilience from those of failing states which has pushed the state towards much more fragility. I mean, do we come up with a certain 1, 2, 3 points, key lessons that we should listen in terms of policy and state builders?
That's an important question. Although it's quite difficult to come up with a certain, pathways that can be applied to different situations, but at least we can highlight some of the key lessons learned. One is pragmatism. Also, we found that pragmatic leadership matters in situations of fragility, especially when it comes to policy formulation. If policies are not realistic, that will lead to the crisis of expectations. And if we look at the cases of East Asian countries, such as Taiwan and other countries, so one of the factor which contributed to building more resilience and improved economy was pragmatism on the part of the leadership. You gave the example of Singapore. But another factor is the types of states being inherited by these countries. If there is a new patrimonial state in place, in patronages, the key to political power, then it's a quite difficult situation. So then comes vision and also political will or honesty, as you put it. There are some of the factors that can contribute, but also we need to be mindful that Singapore is a city state. In fragile states, we are dealing with diverse or divided societies, making a state building or nation building or economic development far more challenging and difficult. And we need to appreciate those, especially coming to a political process. It's demanding, it's time consuming. And we need to have that patience, unfortunately, for political leaders or international community. They focus on quick impact projects rather than having a long horizon about how to build more resilience in these societies. So with that, I would like to conclude that a number of issues are quite important, especially if we need to look at beyond the institutional approach or state building, also focus on nation building. And one of the elements is whether there is an alignment between formal institutions and societal, underlying realities or, let's say, structures. Are they compatible? And then comes to the economy or economic development. So we need to find a thorough balance across them and also prioritize how can we transition from a situation which is more fragile to a less fragile. So for the first thing for nations is how to survive fragility to transition to a more resilient situation.
Thank you so much, Dr. Nematullah Bejan, for your time and availability. It was I enjoyed really this talk, and I will recommend the audience to read this beautiful book, State Fragility, Case Studies and Comparison, which is part of Routledge series of Global Order Studies.
Thank you so much. It has been a pleasure talking to you.